This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Here's a philosophical question. When does an invasive species stop being an invasive and start being just a resident? After all, invasive species have been in North America since Europeans brought them over on the ballast of their ships. I suppose actually most of us here in Vermont could, by some measures, be considered invasive. But leaving philosophy and humans aside for more practical concerns, what should we do with the plant and animal invasives that we are still hoping to get rid of? Well, one possibility is eating them. One species that has wreaked havoc in Vermont is the zebra mussel. Since 1993, the mussels have been clogging pipes, encrusting boats and docks, and altering Lake Champlain's ecological balance. A couple of years ago, I spoke with Mary Watson, then the dean of the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources at UVM, and I asked her if eating zebra mussels might be one way of getting rid of them.
They are edible. I'm not sure that they're all that tasty. In fact, a while ago now, my students actually collected a batch and cooked them, and we made zebra mussel pasta. Don't think the culinary greats have anything to fear, but they wouldn't hurt you if you did eat them.
But not so tasty in your estimation?
They're a little gritty, and they're very small, so they're not like the other mussels that you eat in a seafood restaurant, which actually have some structure to them. They're just these tiny little rubbery pieces without a ton of flavor.
Okay, so maybe not a ringing endorsement, but we are joined today by a true proponent of eating your way through the invasive palate. Joe Roman is a conservation biologist and fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. He's also the editor and founder of Eat the Invaders, a website and movement dedicated to controlling invasive species by dishing them up on the dinner plate. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thanks for inviting me, Jane. Good to see you again.
Have you tried the zebra mussels?
I have not. So I think Mary Watson, who I know as well, probably led me to avoid those. They're tiny. filter feeders at the bottom, yeah, a little too gritty. Lots of other options out there, though.
Well, you say too tiny, but don't you eat periwinkles? Aren't they small?
Periwinkles are a marine snail, but they're eaten in Europe, throughout Europe. And in fact, when I started this idea, I called up Jacques Pepin. Famous French chef. And luckily, on the first call, I got right through to him. And
good to
he
know.
Had said that he had just been out harvesting them with his brother on his coastal home in Connecticut. And they're very simple. Just boil them and quite delicious. So they've got a little bit more meat on them. Still kind of hard to get out of the shell.
All right. So what was the last local invasive that you ate?
So I've been away for a couple of months, but for local invasives, I actually had a lovely meal in Charlotte a few months ago, and we had white perch, which is an invasive fish there that was pan-fried, very simple. So this was several months ago before the winter. Daylilies, which are a common garden plant, the bright orange flower, the flower is delicious just before it blooms. You can pan fry that as well.
Do you eat it the same way you would squash blossoms?
That's right. Okay. Something like a squash blossom. Very simple. And something that you can have any time is something like dandelion wine or dandelion beer. So that's something that, of course, holds over. You start it in the spring and then you can serve it up any time of year. So that those three that come to mind.
You said you were away for a few months. Were you eating invasives wherever you were traveling?
Well, most recently I was in Cuba. And so here's maybe the best endorsement of eating invasives is a lionfish, which is very a major problem. Got into Florida in the 1980s, now found all the way from Rhode Island down throughout the Gulf of Mexico. There, people are hungry there. They allow you to fish lionfish, and we saw more dead ones than we did alive. In fact, 5 days on the water, I only saw one living one. If you were to go to Florida, you'd see them by the hundreds. So there you can see the impact of people going out and eating invasive species. Again, that's for necessity, not necessarily for culinary delicacy, but an effective effort nonetheless.
And in fact, is that one of the things that you are actually hoping to do with eating invasives? Because it can seem kind of gimmicky or, hey, here's a fun party trick. I'm going to serve you invasive cuisine. But you think there's actually a way to help control the spread of invasives or invasives that are already in a region by eating them?
Well, first off, let's just be clear. The most important thing here, we're treating a symptom. So the most important thing is to control the spread of invasives. And we do that in Vermont. There are people out there now who are going to be stewards of boats, so making sure you don't move invasives between different waterways. Another great thing is to restrict bringing any animals or plants into the state that are, unless they're shown to be non-invasive. Right now, we only say, okay, they're invasive, let's not bring them in. But let's show first off that they're not invasive. So just to be clear, that's the real goal here, mm-hmm. is to stop the spread. But that having been said, there are hundreds of invasive species here. And of course, just by the name alone, they're everywhere. If you like to forage like I do, you're going to stumble on one no matter what environment you're in. So here's a chance to go out. First off, have a good meal. Maybe call it a gimmick, if you will. But, you know, it's no more of a gimmick than any other good food that you can get in your local, out of your backyard or in your local ecosystem. The good news is, I work as a conservation biologist. Anytime I go to a restaurant, I'm looking at what's on the menu, especially a seafood restaurant. Like, is this sustainable? Is this good to eat? Should I have it? Should I not? Invasives, you pull that off, right? You say, okay, for the most part, it's going to be a good thing. You're actually making a potentially, maybe a small, but a potentially important change in the environment by eating these. And by bringing restaurateurs on board, I think that's really exciting as well.
You said, but maybe small change. Mm-hmm. Do you think it is a small change, or is there the potential to have a situation like the one you described in Cuba where you actually are making a dent in an invasive population?
I think it depends on, it's species by species. So for something like crayfish, in a river system or in an isolated system, you can make a difference, right? If you're talking about dandelions, let's be honest, we can eat all the dandelions we want, and they're not going to disappear. And that's going to be true for most garden weeds, right? You know, some species, it really is about education and having a good meal. We're not going to eat them out of existence. All that having been said, though, probably people would have argued that a couple of hundred years ago, when passenger pigeons were the most common bird probably on the planet, certainly in North America, numbered in the billions, by 1914 they were gone, largely because we ate them. So there's
seeing similar situations in fisheries.
That's right. Overfishing, people thought they were too abundant, the oceans were too big. They really believed that 100 years ago. Now we know for many species, they're declining. So our appetite definitely has an impact. The question is, does it become more than a boutique cuisine or not to have that impact?
We are talking today with Joe Roman, who's created a website called Eat the Invaders, and we're talking about edible invasives, how to help cull non-native plants and animals by serving them up in delicious dishes. And we'd like to know, listeners, what the best invasive cuisine you've ever tasted is. Have you made or had Japanese knotweed chutney, Asian carp fish sticks, dandelion pasta? You can call in and tell us about it at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your recipes on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling in from Cambridge. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much for having me on the on your program. It's a very interesting and important topic, the whole issue of invasive species. I'm working with the Cambridge Conservation Commission, and we're concerned about the spread of Japanese knotweed in the town of Cambridge. And last year, we did quite a big education program to let people know about this invasive species. And one of the things we did was we encourage people to try tasting Japanese knotweed, and we had several events where we ate we cooked and ate different recipes with Japanese knotweed. One of our favorite ones was Japanese knotweed chutney that was made by Ama from Nama Farm, and we also made chutney. We also made knotweed and strawberry jam and crumble and guacamole and all kinds of things. It tastes very much like it's a sort of lemony flavor. It's related to rhubarb and can be cooked in very similar ways. One of the things that that we realize, and I think this is one of the things that Joe was pointing out, is that we're not going to be able to eradicate Japanese knotweed through eating it, because one of the things is, in fact, by cutting the stems, you actually promote its growth, and you'd have to have a very aggressive cutting regime to slow it down.
Yeah, Sarah, thanks for that. And Joe, I want you to pick up on that point because, you know, one of the questions, I guess, is if this does become more than a boutique mm-hmm. cuisine, do we create a larger market for invasives? And then we're starting to, you know, harvest them and plant them and cultivate them and, you know, it's sort of having the opposite effect of getting rid of them.
That's probably one of the biggest concerns about this, and it's a valid point. And so you need to be clear from the front that the goal is, as one of my friends, you know, in this case, extinction is a happy ending for these species. And you may need to make that clear, whether Sarah, the work that she's doing in Cambridge, or folks that are doing it in restaurants, that we're not promoting quote-unquote sustainable cuisine here. We're trying to reduce the numbers. So that needs to be emphasized from the start, as does the worst-case scenario where people say, oh, this is great, let's move it. So you should never move a living invasive species. The key is you're only, if you're harvesting it, keep it local and make sure that it's dead, that you're not spreading it. So yeah, those are two legitimate concerns, I think.
On the subject of knotweed, we got a note from Karen who wrote on our Facebook page and said, I just made a blueberry knotweed crisp with acorns in the topping the other day. Really good stuff. Have you made anything with knotweed? We've heard about knotweed chutney and, you know, Sarah was talking about a lot of things, including guacamole.
I have cooked it up sort of like you would asparagus. I found it a little stringy. That may be because I'm more of a conservation biologist than a chef, just to be clear. But I have had the Japanese knotweed chutney with that meal that I was telling you about that Sarah actually had supplied, and it was fantastic. It was probably one of the best things that we had there. That sour taste makes for really good chutneys, pies, muffins, those sort of things.
It sounds like it could almost be a little bit rhubarb-like, stringy and a little bit tart. Is that an accurate
Yes.
connection?
Yeah.
Okay. We got a note as well from Laura who says, I had one of the most delicious meals of my life made with invasive jellyfish. It was sushi, peanut butter, and jellyfish at Mia's Sushi in New Haven, Connecticut, a restaurant in which the owner himself dives for the seafood and serves nothing but unthreatened species. He has a menu of invasive species dishes. This makes the menu completely different than a typical sushi restaurant, and I eagerly await the day when I can return there to have that delicious dish once again. I want to point out, Vermont writer Rowan Jacobson has written an article in Outside Magazine about that very restaurant and including Joe Roman, and we have a link to it on our Facebook page. It's a fantastic article and really fun to read. And Joe, you know the restaurant that Laura is talking about.
I know the restaurant, and I know Bun Lai, and he's one of my culinary heroes. As he says proudly, people walk into his sushi restaurant every day and walk out because they go in expecting tuna, salmon, seaweed salad, and he doesn't serve any of those traditional things. He
no
made a
tail.
Decision. That's right. He made the decision several years ago that he was going to take all unsustainable products out of the menu, off the menu, and start bringing in things that you talked about earlier about zebra mussels. I've been collecting crabs as part of my research for years, and there's a very small one called the Asian shore crab. It's maybe about the size of your thumb, and I never thought that you could eat it. But what Bun does is he fries it up, and Rowan Jacobson in that article describes it as Doritos with legs. do you want Doritos with legs? I don't know, but it's actually quite delicious. It's all about the seasoning that goes into it as well. If you have a chance.
And you just eat them with the shell, so it's like, you know, soft shell crab eating kind of.
Right, like you might call it popcorn crab. Crabs uh-huh. would be a way to think about it. And they're fabulous. And that's something we're never going to run out of either, I don't think. I mean, you see them everywhere. And this is one thing about invasives. The sad thing is there's always a new ingredient. I wish this weren't the case. But when I started my research, European green crabs are very common. They're large from Europe. They've been in the U.S. since the early 1900s. In the 1980s, Asian shore crab came in. Now that's all over New England and really the most dominant crab there. Again, I didn't think you could eat it, but Bun has showed me otherwise. He's an artist with food. I mean, he's always experimenting.
Do you know of any restaurateurs here in Vermont who are experimenting with invasive cuisine?
I don't, but I've been promoting, I've been talking with folks, so I'm hoping that'll change. Certainly, we see them in Washington, D.C., in Texas with feral hogs. So you might be able to get something like a wild hog on the menu here. But I haven't seen, and I would be great if someone called in and said that, it could correct me, but there's lots of local foraged products that are out there. So maybe it's very easy to start with some the common garden weeds, for example. Think about dandelions or burdock or garlic mustard, three that come in mind that are easy to prepare, or Japanese knotweed, of course.
And in fact, you have some recipes on your website, Eat the Invaders, so people could get some tips from you.
That's right. And we also have a place for citizen invasivores, so you can post your own recipes there too.
Oh, good. I love this idea, and you know, maybe I love just sort of the novelty of it, but it's an interesting concept too, to think about whether or not you can help control an invasive species through eating it, through putting it on the cuisine and hoping to have an unsustainable cuisine, which is a lot different than what we're hearing in most food discussions. And listeners, we do want to hear from you. We want to hear, you know, what questions you have, maybe about how to figure out if an invasive is edible or good to eat, or any recipe ideas you have. You can post them on our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Joe Roman is the editor and founder of Eat the Invaders, a website and movement dedicated to controlling invasive species by dishing them up. And that's what we're discussing today, edible invasive cuisine, and what you might be able to try right here in Vermont. Let us know if you have questions about how to figure out what's edible, not to mention tasty, and you can share recipes or suggestions you have. Again, there's a discussion going on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or you can call in 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Windsor. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. This is Michael from Windsor, and I would like to recommend the rusty crayfish be on the menu. It's an invasive crayfish. The work on it was pioneered by an eighth-grade girl from the Hartford Middle School, and it is extremely abundant. It's easily identified. It's a crayfish, and it has two rusty spots on its back as though you had red paint on your fingers when you picked it up, and the tips of the claws are black, and crayfish are delicious, and it's extremely abundant in the streams and river. She worked in the White River. I found it to be just about the only crayfish in the streams in Windsor. So I would recommend that.
Have you tried it, Michael?
Well, I have eaten crayfish in the past, but since in a long time now, I don't eat meat, so I haven't.
Mm.
I haven't tried that species, but back in Pennsylvania, I used to teach a course called Arthropod Cuisine, where I taught people to eat insects and crayfish. And so I have eaten crayfish a lot, but I've never eaten the rusty crayfish. But I know some of the biologists from Waterbury who came down to work with the student. When they left, they had buckets full of rusty crayfish because they collected them for the research, but they weren't allowed to do anything with them. It was illegal to transport them, so they took them back and ate them. You might ask the state fish and wildlife folks in Waterbury how they actually taste, but I could say connection that would be it. That crayfish are delicious because I've eaten them in the past, and the rusty crayfish is a really bad invasive, and it's extremely abundant in the streams, and it's easy to identify.
Well, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate that. Is the rusty crayfish the one that you are eating, Joe Roman, in the streams near your house?
Yeah, they're around throughout Vermont now, so a big concern, and I can vouch that they're quite tasty. There, I think, are five species that have now invaded, probably through fisheries as bait, but relatively easy to find, and certainly I highly recommend them. They're fabulous.
Are there any native crayfish species, or you know, maybe more broadly, how do you know that you're harvesting an invasive and not damaging a native population?
You definitely want to check before to look. I guess they would probably look at local websites. As he had said, the rusty crayfish has those spots. You definitely want to know that you're taking the invasive. I mean, the sad thing is that it's most likely because they're going to tend to be more common.
Mm-hmm.
So if you set traps out, you're likely to catch the invasives, but you certainly certainly would like to do some research early on. That's a very good point.
Let's go to Toby, who's on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Toby.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I do a lot of foraging, and I've always been curious about the zebra mussels, if they were safe to eat. I eat a lot of freshwater mussels, but I've never eaten those. And the other thing that I'm really curious if it's something that we can eat is the wild, cow parsnip that grows alongside the road that's just kind of a new introduction. And the roots smell delicious, and I have thought that they would be something that would be really good boiled.
Yeah. All right. So what about that, Joe Roman? Do you know about parsnip, wild parsnip?
Yes, that is edible, though I confess that I haven't tried it. So be careful. Obviously, it can cause a skin rash. And so this one is not an easy one to approach. But the as far as I know, the root is edible. It is the parsnip that we know.
Okay, so as is edible. And, you know, I would also recommend, Toby, talk to a forager. It sounds like you've done a lot of foraging yourself, but talk to some foragers in your area. We've had a couple on the show. You know, you do want to make sure that whatever you are foraging is edible, because sometimes plants can look very similar and one of them may be edible and one not. So the foragers that we've always talked to said, if you don't know, just ask somebody who might. And if you're not sure, don't eat it. But, Joe Roman, you're saying at least you, as far as you know, wild parsnip is edible.
Yes, but thank you for that, Jane. There are lots of good apps out now that can help you make these decisions. It's probably a good idea to go out with someone who's eaten these, who's foraged for these before. There are some species that look like others that may be, you know, slightly toxic. So, yeah, be careful. Good point.
You've eaten garlic mustard?
Oh, yeah, garlic mustard is great. As pesto, you can also eat it raw, but it's cooked up, it's delicious. And that's quite common, especially in southern Vermont, and easy to find, unfortunately, especially along roadsides or in forests.
Now, you might expect garlic mustard tastes like garlic and mustard. Mm-hmm. What does it really taste like?
It is garlicky, actually, and it's got that. So, you know, it's related to broccoli and other plants like that. And so it's fantastic and very easy to harvest and very easy to prepare. You want to do it early in the spring, so get ready.
All right. So if you're going to have some garlic mustard pesto, you might want something to put it on. How about a lovely fish dish? How about an Asian carp fish dish? Now, if you were a college student, would you actually give that a try if it was on the menu in one of your dining halls? Well, Richard O'Donohue is one of the chefs at Middlebury College, and he has found that there is an appetite for such things, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Richard. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thank you.
So you have served Asian carp in the dining halls at Middlebury College.
Yes, we have. We've done a little over 800 pounds in various different ways. The staff and I got together and I discussed how come this was an invasive species and the impact it has on the environment. And staff came up with different kinds of recipes and different creative ways of cooking it. There is a lot of bones in the fish, and that was the one thing that we had to get through, and grinding was the easiest way to serve it when we were doing it. And we made everything from, you know, fish tacos and patties and lasagna. We made a white sauce, quiches. We actually made some sausage, Italian sausage with it, because I think the gluten from the bones, even when they're ground, was a great binder.
That doesn't sound very appealing when you say it like that, though, Richard.
I realize, but once it's cooked, and you know, we just cut the fillets down, and we bread them and fried them. And the kids, you know, the students tried them. The ones that were really into what we were doing, they took it. We seasoned them differently with Indian seasonings, Grandma Marcella's, and a lot of the foreign students ate those, and they were quite surprised. The carp took on a flavor of almost anything you did with it. We've done them cold, like a pate, and with some sauces, and they and, you know, dips and spreads, and the students tried it. Our big point of doing it was to show the impact that these species are having on could have on the Great Lakes, and then eventually get to Vermont.
Yeah, we should point out, as far as I know, the Asian carp in the Great Lakes is causing a lot of damage, but it's not here yet.
Not yet, no, but follow the waterways and the tributaries, and it's as far from the Mississippi River through the Illinois River. Its last report I was following was it's in the Sandusky River in Ohio. So that's, you know, that's coming, which is a tributary to the Lake Erie.
Mm, yeah, so it's headed this way.
Unfortunately, yeah.
So, you know, first of all, I have to say, pate for college students sounds like pretty good living if you're eating in a dining hall. What was the reaction that students had when you said, hey, we're serving you Asian carp with a lot of gluten in your sausage?
Well, what we did was we put out a lot of information about the Asian carp and the impact it had on the Mississippi River and the threat to Lake Michigan through Chicago. The impact, just to get an awareness out about the carp. And then we told them a few days it would be arriving and we'll start cooking it in different ways. So a lot of them, you know, came up during lunch and dinner and they would talk to the chefs and ask all kind of questions. And like I said, some were, you know, very turned off by them and some were very excited about it. So we didn't just serve the Asian carp. We had other food along with it. It was the Asian carp was a supplement to whatever lunch or dinner we were doing.
Well, and you can always have your Fruit Loops, I suppose, in the college dining
exactly.
hall.
Exactly. And, you know, the cost at the time we were doing it was about $2.40 a pound.
Compare that to other fish that you buy.
$5, double the time, double and more than that. So.
Ah, so it was actually a cheaper option.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So we could use most of it, and we just expose the students to it, and hopefully they'll carry it on when they graduated the years that we did it, and be aware when they read about it, knowing that we cooked it here. You know, we tried getting the whole fish up, and then interest changed, and we never did. But, we did 800 pounds of it, and for us, that was a pretty good start.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty good.
Yeah, that's great.
We've been watching and trying to follow through Reinhardt Food Service in Burlington. The director up there who helps us buy all our food, Fernando Crescendo is his name, and he every time we call him, he's wondering what's coming up. And the Asian carp took him by surprise, and then we found out about the snakehead in the Chesapeake Bay and Delaware area. And this is a fish that can live on land for 3 days.
Wow.
And they attack people in the water. And they also, like fishermen, will be fishing in wader boots and that. And their teeth are so sharp, they can chomp through the wader boots.
Oh, well, I'm not sure I want to try that. Richard, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today to talk a little bit about, the fact that this kind of cuisine can be done on a large scale. I mean, you're serving lots of students. So thank you so much for telling us a little bit about it. I really appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
Richard O'Donohue is the chef at Proctor Dining Hall at Middlebury College. And Joe, you wanted to comment on that cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's perfect. The point here that Richard was making is that it's about education, and that really is that's the best result of this, is to get the word out about invasives and to think about how we can control it in different ways, one through prevention, two through other ways, such as eating them. As far as the Asian carp goes, their company just started up in Kentucky that's selling it back to Asia, where there is a market for it. So we're starting to see even some companies that are selling it internationally at this point. And as far as the snakehead, maybe it doesn't sound that pretty, but it tastes really good. It's you can make it in ceviche and prepare it in many different ways. And it's on some of the great restaurants in D.C., Annapolis, Maryland now. Some states decide not to sell it. Virginia, it's illegal to move it at all, live or dead. So not every state allows you to move invasives. You should have a heads up on that. I'm not aware of anything like that in Vermont.
Well, just speaking of the snakehead, we got a note from Anderson who says, in the Washington, D.C. area, I've eaten a number of dishes dishes made from the northern snakehead fish in both Chinese restaurants and on upscale modern American menus. Local fish and wildlife officials there have been attempting to build a market for the snakehead as a way of combating the rapidly spreading voracious fish that presents a real threat to local fish and shellfish in the Chesapeake Bay. So Anderson says, delicious.
Yep, I agree.
Let's go to David calling in from Sharon. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Congratulations on the new baby.
Thank you.
I was wondering if anybody had thought to use some of these invasives like the Asian carp and stuff like that for pet food.
Oh, good question. You know about that, Joe?
Yeah, there's a company called Marsh Dog out of Louisiana. And Louisiana has been trying to market Nutria, which is an invasive rodent that was brought in for the fur industry in the late 19th century and has since gone wild and has found it's damaging marshes throughout a lot of the southern U.S. all the way up to as far north as Maryland. And after they failed to really get people to eat it, they've started serving it up as dog food. It's called Marsh Dog. And so yes, there are some attempts to that. I think that's a good way, or, you know, also feed for other animals as well. I mean, cattle can eat weeds too. I mean, lots of species can eat invasives. So yeah, that's a great idea.
Let's go to Devin calling in from Rockingham. Hi, Devin.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Hi, Joe. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I made up a pretty good batch of autumn olive fruit leather last fall and really enjoyed that.
Autumn olive?
Yeah.
Autumn olive. Got it.
autumn olive. Yeah, yeah. About that. Yeah, which is a delicious invasive. And I guess I just wanted to call and represent the view that seems to be often lacking in the discussion. Just basically to look at the source of where invasives, and I, if I were writing invasives, I would probably put it in quotation marks, because to me there's a significant debate about where these species come from and why they're spreading the way that they are, and you know, when we think and talk about controlling invasives, I think it's worth considering the human influence.
Yeah, you know what, Devin, you are just speaking right up Joe Roman's alley here, and I'm going to toss this to him because we're short on time, but I really appreciate you making that point. And Joe, I mean, we are talking here about something serious, habit fragmentation, invasives. I mean, invasives come in and take the place of native species. That's why they're invasive and not just introduced. So speak a little bit more to Devin's point before we let you go.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Devin. Yeah, so when we're talking about invasives, in this case, we're talking about non-native species that have come from outside, extralimital, outside the U.S. typically, or from different parts of the U.S. We're not talking about species that are doing well necessarily because habitat has changed. Clearly, we have a large influence that invasive species, non-native invasives, often do better as a result of habitat change or pollution or all kinds of things that are changing, or we're reducing native species. So all of these things are in play here. And the key is control. That is trying to control the spread of these species in every way. That is first, before they get here, whether it's through preventing species being moved through ballast water or through the pet trade. And then once they're here, what are we going to do about it? Monitor them. Rapid response is key.
And maybe eat them.
And put them on our plates.
Joe Roman is a conservation biologist and a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. He's the editor and founder of Eat the Invaders, and we have a link to his website at vpr.net. Also, please continue to post your invasive recipes or photos on our Facebook page. We have lots of links there, including some interesting articles. Joe Roman, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A deadly virus has been spreading through the nation's pig populations. Porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, or PED, has killed about 4 or 5 million hogs since it was identified in the United States in May of last year. Earlier this week, the Agency of Agriculture announced that the first cases of PED have been identified in Vermont. Shelley Mellenbacher is the assistant state veterinarian for the Vermont Department of Agriculture, and she joins us now to talk a little bit about it. Shelley, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks, Jane. It's good to be back.
And I have to apologize to our listeners. I am so sorry to follow a segment about delicious invasive cuisine with something called porcine epidemic diarrhea. But Shelley, can you please tell us what it is?
I sure can. Porcine epidemic diarrhea is a viral disease that causes, can be very severe, watery diarrhea and vomiting in pigs of all ages when it occurs on a farm. Keep in mind that it is a pig-only disease. It doesn't affect other species or humans, and it's not a food safety issue, so pork is still definitely safe to eat. Most pigs in any phase of a production herd will become sick, and death loss in nursing pigs could approach 100%. So that tends to be the cue or the key that something is going on your farm, and that's the large amount of piglet death. The virus is shed in feces, and the infection route is through oral contact with contaminated feces. And the most common sources that people should be aware of for infection would be pigs themselves, feces that could be on trucks, boots, clothing, or other inanimate objects. And the pigs can shed the virus in their feces for about 3 to 4 weeks, so that's important to keep in mind. And any producers who see any signs of illness that might seem similar to what I was just talking about should definitely notify their herd veterinarian to address the issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a pretty descriptive illness by name. But so what producers should be looking for are pigs with really severe diarrhea?
Yeah, so I would say severe diarrhea, maybe some vomiting, and then definitely death in the piglets, unfortunately.
And you said 100% mortality, approaching 100% mortality for piglets.
That is correct.
That sounds awful. I mean, it's just sort of awful to think about a disease spreading that quickly and killing all of these little piglets.
Yeah, there are lots of diseases that, unfortunately, floating around the United States that can be really severe, and this is a new virus to the pig community. It's been present in other countries since about the 70s, but again, it is new to the U.S., and it was first confirmed in the middle of May of 2013.
I want to reiterate, too, this does not affect the meat, you said, so people don't need to be worried about eating pork products.
No, I mean, this is a virus, and viruses are, you know, all over the place. They can affect many different species, and including us, and generally there isn't a food safety issue from a virus that I would be concerned about.
Now, I mentioned that this has spread pretty rapidly, and you were saying, you know, it's actually identified in the 70s, but since last year when it was discovered here, it's killed 4 or 5 million pigs, mostly piglets, but it's only been identified so far in one farm in Vermont. Do you have a sense, if this spreads more rapidly here, how much of a hit this could be for pork producers in the state?
It's really hard to tell, Jane, because I don't have a particular list of how many people are producing pigs. You know, people aren't required to report anything to the agency regarding what types of animals they are producing. So it's really hard to say what the economic impact could be. And it would also depend maybe on the structure of the particular production practices. Do they just have the older pigs and they might have more of a chance to survive? There's a lot of varying effects, so it's really hard to say what the impact could be.
Okay, so bottom line, Shelley, for people who are pig producers, pork producers, bottom line on how to stop the spread of it or prevent it from getting onto your farm.
I'm so glad you asked that, because that's what I wanted to emphasize. The most important thing for producers to do would be to keep going with hopefully what they already have done in terms of biosecurity measures. And so biosecurity measures are things that the livestock industry is already familiar with, and they basically indicate certain measures that people do to take to prevent the spread of disease either off of a farm or onto a farm. And so that would be really basic things like wearing coveralls and wearing rubber boots. You wash those boots before you go onto another farm, or you just use particular clothes on a particular farm, making sure that any vehicles that come onto your farm are clean and aren't carrying any types of manure. It's basically just being really clean and wearing particular clothes on a particular farm. You can also consider, if you take new animals onto your farm, isolating those for a period of time to see if they show any signs of diseases, and then definitely employing a veterinarian to work with you on biosecurity practices and also other disease prevention or just the herd health practices.
And you know what? We're going to put some of those tips that you just mentioned up on our webpage because it's a lot to digest if you're trying to just hear it and write it down. So we'll put that all up. And Shelley, I really appreciate you alerting us to this newly found illness in pigs in Vermont.
Yeah, thanks, Jan. I'm more than happy to be of assistance, and I appreciate you putting those that information up. And people can go to our website at agriculture.vermont.gov to look for some of those biosecurity practices.
All right. Shelley Mellenbacher is the assistant state veterinarian, and she's been telling us about porcine epidemic diarrhea. And finally today, we are going to cleanse the palate. We are talking about bird watching your way to wellness. Robert Valliere had always wanted to be a career soldier, but a friendly fire accident in Kuwait during the Persian Gulf War left him seriously injured and unable to return to military service. Like many veterans, Robert tried clinics, painkillers, and conventional therapy to adjust to civilian life. But it was the quiet activity of bird watching that finally allowed him to find his new normal. Robert has recently written a book about his experience. It's called Wounded Warriors, A Soldier's Story of Healing Through Birds. And he spoke with VPR's Rick Singeri.
You did suffer a traumatic brain injury, and you've had to deal with PTSD after coming back. So what is it about bird watching that has been so therapeutic for you?
Well, partially is you're looking out. Think of this weather, right, that's going on outside, and you have nothing to do. You don't want to be staring at this stupid television, although it is educational at sometimes. And during my son's nap times, I often was wondering, yes, this is good, but I need some other things. I need to start going outside. I need to do things. I need to stay physically fit. And when you see that little feathered friend fly through and you wonder what kind of bird it is, it kind of inspires you. There's a part in the book about our feathered, well, actually it's all about feathered friends and how they inspire. And they're creatures of God just like the rest of us.
The book is presented in a series of journal entries that alternate between the events leading up to your injury more than 20 years ago and your present-day birding experiences. Why did you choose to write it using journal entries?
While I'm out there, I have these flashbacks. And so part of the therapeutic part is that it just came out. It inspires poetry. It inspires a lot of things.
Robert, give us an idea of what a typical bird watching trip entails. What's it like for you?
For instance, I just happened to go out yesterday, you know, because I knew the storm was coming. I said, I want to see some birds. There's going to be some stuff out there. And it can be as close as your own backyard or right outside the window. There might be some pigeons doing the dance of the mating season because spring brings new hope. And so there were some pigeons on doing a dance while I was waiting for my doctor's appointment at the VA in Manchester. And wham, here comes a raptor and takes a pigeon right away. And it's phenomenal. It's kind of exciting, but it's kind of horrific. But so is war. And I was just trying to be some type of a difference in lives, and this is the way birding affected me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What have been some of the most interesting birds that you've been able to cross off your life list that you've seen?
I never thought about a life list, you know, so every bird that comes through me is my life list. People do birding for certain reasons. People do birding because they love it, and people do birding because it inspires something in them to get outside. It does things that will keep you going on a daily basis. Yellow-shafted flicker. Have you ever seen a yellow-shafted flicker?
I don't believe I have.
It's amazing.
Is there a bird you're still searching for?
Yes, there is. It's the deer falcon, and we only see it sometimes. It migrates through here. It's a bird of the Arctic, and it breeds up in the Arctic. But when you think of extreme things like, have you seen any articles on the snowy owls that have been coming through here?
I have, absolutely.
Oh, and do you, what fascinates you about that?
The fact that we've been able to see them so readily at this time year, and they just are such a majestic bird.
Yes, and to think they breed in this type of weather and stuff, it's just phenomenal. Oh, so one bird that I've been searching for, the bald eagle. So I found some bald eagles not too far from here in Canterbury, and it's a new nest, so I'm pumped up about that.
What do you hope people will draw from your book when they read it?
Well, some type of inspiration, some type of... if I can help one veteran, that's what I want to do. You know, we all come back with... Everything affects each and every one of us. We're all connected in some way. And I just wanted to give some type of justice to the people who have helped raise me, who've helped given me hope.
Robert Valliers, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and it's such a privilege.
That was VPR's Rick Singeri speaking with Robert Valliers. His new book with Jacqueline Howard is called Wounded Warriors, A Soldier's Story of Healing Through Birds. That's it for today's show. Tomorrow, the details in a new report that spells out what went wrong with the state's healthcare exchange.